Another slowdown in Asia as Japan reports slowing growth.
And Mitt Romney's VP choice, Paul Ryan, where is he coming from? What are his economic priorities? I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, August 13th. Coming up, Google announces it's going to cut thousands of jobs at Motorola Mobility, which it bought just recently. And we're going to check into the reasons behind that and maybe the reasons then that Google decided to buy this company in the first place.
Some other interesting tidbits, like why it's getting harder to rent an apartment in Chicago all of a sudden. And all about that tape that you're seeing all of our athletes' bodies, beach volleyballers especially, throughout the Olympics. That and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
New figures out this morning show Japan's economy is slowing down. It grew at a rate of 1.4% in the latest three-month period. That's down sharply from the previous quarter. For more on what's behind it, let's bring in the BBC's Mariko Oi. She's with us from Tokyo. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, so we've heard about a slowdown in Japan, in China, in Europe, in the United States. What's unique about Japan in terms of its economy right now?
Well, one big difference about Japan is that its economy is recovering from last year's earthquake and tsunami. And part of the reason that Japan's economy grew very strongly in the first 3 months of this year was because of the government spending on the reconstruction. But we're starting to see a slowdown in that. And even though the central bank, the Bank of Japan, has been hoping that consumers will continue to spend, today's figures show that that might not be the case. So it might be a bit of a worrying sign for the central bank.
Well, how are consumers feeling? I mean, they've been through so much economically in Japan over the last couple of years.
Well, I spoke to one couple in their 50s, and I was filing a report about the household budget, and they showed me, I guess, a pie chart of their budget, and they make quite a good money, but almost half of its entire salary is on spent on a housing loan, because they feel that they want to pay off the loan as soon as possible, just in case they need extra cash when they retire. And even younger people, I was just having drinks with my girlfriends on Friday, just after the bill to double the sales tax passed the parliament, and their immediate reaction was, that's it, I'm going to stop spending in Japan, I'm just going to go overseas and go shopping there. So I guess that's the concern that critics have of this particular bill, because it seems like consumers aren't spending as much as the government had been hoping.
The BBC's Mariko Oi in Tokyo, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy, Japan's stock market, at least in the form of the Nikkei index, just sat tight in the wake of those new figures. Not much movement in general across Europe and Asia. And at this early hour, U.S. markets seem to be following a similarly unexciting course, unless something else comes along to shake things up.
But, of course, something has just come along to shake up the presidential race. Jeff, I don't know if you were trying
Very nice.
To lead me into that or not, but
well done.
Wisconsin Congressman and now Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan will be in Iowa today. He's going to be talking with voters at the state fair. It's Ryan's first solo appearance since Mitt Romney announced him as his running mate on Saturday. And, of course, we're going to hear a lot about Paul Ryan in the coming days, but we will start today with the legislation that he is most associated with, and that would be, of course, the Ryan budget plan. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Paul Ryan's plan would reform the tax code. There'd be two individual rates, one at 10%, the other at 25%. And as Ryan explained last night on 60 Minutes, he thinks government programs like Medicare aren't sustainable, and we have to overhaul them to save them.
In order to make sure we can do that, you must reform it for those of us who are younger.
Americans who are 55 and older wouldn't see their benefits change, but there'd be big changes for younger Americans. There wouldn't be any more unlimited Medicare spending. Instead, the government would issue vouchers. The so-called Ryan budget also calls for big cuts to discretionary spending. That's money that pays for things like highways and national parks. By 2050, Ryan wants that scaled back drastically.
We need policies that grow the economy to get people back to work. That helps with revenues, that helps with growth, and that helps reduce spending.
What Ryan's budget doesn't tackle is Social Security or defense spending. The Pentagon is 20% of the federal budget. Even before he became Romney's running mate, Ryan made a three-minute video for his most recent budget proposal. In this election, he says there's a choice between prosperity, as he puts it, or becoming the next Greece.
The question is, which future will we choose?
That question takes on even more significance now. Nicholas Carnes teaches public policy at Duke.
If Romney's goal was to clearly distinguish himself from the president on economic issues, he couldn't have picked a better person in Washington to do that.
Or a better way through the Ryan budget to highlight that difference. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Since this election is so much about jobs and the economy, it's only natural to compare and contrast Ryan and Romney's views to see where the ticket stands. One good place to start, those bailouts, both the bank bailouts and the auto company bailouts. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is on the case this morning. Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
So the Romney campaign has sent mixed messages on how he would have handled the bank bailout. Romney's been outspoken, though, against bailing out the auto companies. What's Paul Ryan's record on that stuff?
Well, it's interesting because Ryan is very much about small government, but that's caused him to vote for government intervention in business. Mm-hmm. So Ryan voted for both TARP, the bank bailout, and the auto bailouts. He had his reasons. A GM plant had closed in his hometown of Janesville back in 2008, 2009, and there were layoffs at other plants, so he felt some pressure there. And for TARP, he reasoned that the government intervention in a time of crisis would prevent a bigger bailout later, or say the government taking over the banks entirely. So it seems his thinking was that a little bit of poison would help bring about a cure.
Paul Ryan's life is about to get plenty of extra attention. And this morning, you've been looking through some new documents on his stock trades right around the time of the financial crisis. What do you got?
Yeah, it gives you a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder for the financial crisis to read those trades. OpenSecrets.org just released his trading history, and it shows that on the same day that Ryan met with Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke about potential government bailouts of the financial firms, he also sold some financial stocks. He sold shares in Citigroup, General Electric, and Wachovia, but he bought stock in one firm, in Goldman Sachs. And that was a day that the market was up 400 points, expecting a government intervention. Of course, now that kind of move would be illegal. The Stock Act prevents members of Congress from using the confidential information they get on the Hill to guide their stock trades. But of course, he did vote for the Stock Act.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, Mitt Romney's choice of Paul Ryan surprised plenty of people. He's young. He's got plenty of legislative baggage, lots of votes in his history, which is not always an easy thing for a campaign. And he's a deficit guy when polls suggest many voters care mostly about jobs right now. A new piece in Politico suggests he's surprising, maybe encouraging, I don't know, for another reason, his passion for math, at least the math of federal budgets. He's a substance guy, you could say. Politico's Glenn Thrush co-wrote the article. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
You suggest Paul Ryan is a fascinating pick because choosing him means choosing an adult conversation about the economy, about the deficit. How so?
Romney has pretty much tried every single approach against Barack Obama, most of them negative. And this is like a Hail Mary pass on substance. It's not merely just a discussion of core conservative principles, which I think a lot of people have cast this pick as being, but it's really a move to change the tone of the conversation and really to kind of beat Barack Obama with his own 2008 messaging. So this is really a throwback move to Hope and Change 4 years ago.
With all the money in the race and the ads coming from outside groups, I don't think anybody would expect us to return to like the days of Lincoln Douglas here. Do you think, though, that Paul Ryan can maybe just pull us in that more adult direction? What would that look like?
Listen, I think the debates are going to be everything this year. And I think the Ryan-Biden debate in particular is going to be really, really interesting. And Ryan will interject a real discussion of deficit reduction on both the vice presidential and presidential side. The question is, where does it lead? And weren't we supposed to be talking about jobs? Haven't we been told since the beginning of last year that the only thing that Romney cared about was jobs, 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 and all of a sudden we're talking about deficit? They've got to bridge those two things.
So since Paul Ryan is Mr. Deficit, 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 give us something else about him that we're not hearing so much about right at the moment that might help us better understand his approach to economic policy.
Well, I think one of the things to understand about Paul Ryan is he comes from a family construction business. But really, since his mid-20s, he has mostly collected a government paycheck. Remember, he's been in the House for the last 14 years since he's 28 years old. So he's this interesting combination of a guy whose early life was sort of spent in the middle and lower rungs of the private sector, and whose life since then has been almost entirely receiving a public paycheck.
Glenn Thrush is a reporter for Politico. He's got an e-book coming out in about a week called Obama's Last Stand. Good to talk with you, Glenn.
Take care.
Google announced this morning it will lay off 4,000 people. They are all employees of Motorola Mobility, which Google recently bought. The layoffs account for 20% of Motorola Mobility's workforce. For more on this, let's bring in Henry Blodgett. He's CEO of Business Insider. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is Google up to here?
So Google is finally taking steps to restructure Motorola, which it bought last year. This was very much expected, although these are very deep cuts, so I think they will cause some consternation. But basically, when Google announced that it was buying Motorola, a lot of people said, well, this is just for the patents. It became clear over the process of closing the deal that Google actually wants to make smartphones and tablets and compete directly with Apple on integrated devices. And as soon as that became clear, the next conclusion was that Google was going to have to restructure Motorola, and that's what they're doing.
Well, what about Motorola, though? I mean, this is an 84-year-old company. It was a leader in the world of cell phones, and even as recently as 2004, it came out with the famous Razr, which was really a very impressive phone at the time.
That's right. Unfortunately, the smartphone business has moved so fast in the last 5 to 6 years that a lot of old line companies have been completely blindsided. You look at Nokia, which was the global leader just a few years ago. Research in Motion, which was the smartphone leader, has been completely destroyed. And Motorola has also been leapfrogged. And so this is a company that certainly has some good products that people like, very much American success story, but they have been leapfrogged by the iPhone. And that has put the company really on its heels. And I think Google's hope is that they will now be able to use their software with Motorola's design processes and come up with phones that are directly competitive with the iPhone and some of the Samsung phones.
Henry Blodgett, CEO of Business Insider, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, while we're talking about patents, final arguments are expected to wrap up this week in the Apple-Samsung trial. Apple is claiming that Samsung copied its designs for the iPhone and iPad. But Marketplace's Queen Akim reports the trial is also giving the public a rare peek into Apple's inner workings.
For Apple geeks, this trial's like entering Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Like the chocolate factory, Apple is infamous for its secrecy.
No one must look under there. This is the most secret machine in my entire factory.
During the trial, Apple said it took 3 years to make the iPhone, and it had a code name, Project Purple. And the first rule of Project Purple, you don't talk about Project Purple. Then there's Sir John Ive, who led Apple through 40 prototypes to get the iPhone right.
He kind of works in the equivalent of like an evil genius super lair.
John Brown Lee reports for the Cult of Mac. He says the prototypes could provide competitors with useful information.
We're basically looking into Johnny Ive's mind and how he's gone about designing this phone. It's the equivalent of getting access to Leonardo da Vinci notebook.
Eric Goldman is the director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University. And I asked him, what do you think Steve Jobs would have thought about all this information coming out?
I think we know the answer to that.
Goldman says Apple took a calculated risk. If it wins, it could get billions and beat back Samsung. But if Apple loses, it'll have nothing to show for revealing how the chocolate is made. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, you know it took NASA years of painstaking work and about $2.5 billion to build the rover Curiosity.
Yeah.
Landed not too long ago. We've been talking about it. Well, now you can make one yourself for a couple of bucks, maybe with your kid if you have one, maybe in about an hour. Are you into Legos? This is a silly question to ask a grown man.
I was a huge Lego fan when I was a kid. I remember making like the Lego airport and all that. I loved Legos.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not so silly, actually, because an engineer who worked on the real Curiosity rover, well, apparently he's really into Legos, and he's posted step-by-step instructions, a PDF file, on how to build your own tiny version of the Curiosity rover. Hmm. And it's very, very detailed, and the instructions themselves are very meticulous, as I have found with my son. Lego instructions are now. It's kind of crazy. One disclaimer, though, this one will not do a graceful landing on your kitchen table like the Curiosity rover did on Mars. Don't drop it.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Chicago has long been known as a good city for renters. Got reasonable rents, lots of cool neighborhoods to choose from. Compare that to New York. You know it better than I do, Jeremy. But is this apocryphal or not, that people actually follow the obituaries to try to score an affordable place?
That sounds a little bit excessive to me. But, you know, rents are very very high here. So it's kind of hard to get a good one. Yeah.
To nab one of those rare rent-controlled apartments, maybe, I think you have to sort of watch carefully.
Oh, yeah.
To see when somebody...
people hang on to those for generations.
Right. And when someone kicks the bucket, you got to move fast. Well, apocryphal or not, it's a more difficult market. Let's talk about Chicago again. Lately, in Chicago, renters looking in the hippest neighborhoods are surprised to find themselves scrambling for a spot, which they haven't had to do in the past. From WBEZ in Chicago, here's Lauren Chulgen.
Megan Russell has been renting in Chicago for 4 years now, but this time she's moving in with her boyfriend. They want to live near the Wicker Park neighborhood. It's a pretty hip area on the northwest side of the city. Lots of dive bars, vegan restaurants, and bike shops. She says renting in Chicago used to be a breeze, but ask her how it's going this year.
Horrible. Things have been going crazy fast. I've been looking for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I've been on Craigslist nonstop, walking on streets, calling, and places are going faster than I can even see them.
Russell's standing outside a two-bedroom apartment. It's just 1,100 square feet, and it isn't even finished. There aren't any cabinets, countertops, or light fixtures. Yet in the course of an hour, almost a dozen other people come to see it.
A couple of years ago, you could, like, you know, see a place and think about it. Now it's like if you don't sign the lease when you see it, you're screwed.
Sure enough, the unit she was looking at rented just 2 days later to someone else.
A lot of people were buying who now realize it's not quite the best idea.
Dennis Rodkin writes a column for Chicago Magazine. He's the real estate guru in the city. He says many of those younger would-be buyers a few years ago have now become renters.
There's also an inflow of people who were owners who, for whatever reason, can't afford to own anymore. They've been foreclosed and they've converted to renting.
And Rodkin says that means more expensive rent. That little unit Russell is looking at, for example, is going for $1,500 a month. The property manager there says 5 years ago, it would have gone for $1,000. But Rodkin says this won't ruin Chicago's reputation as a renter-friendly city. Renters will just have to accept that they might not live in the center of everything.
People will push those boundaries. They'll go out to some of the neighborhoods they haven't already looked in. And the trade-off would be you have to commute in to go to the great restaurants you like, but you've got far more space and you found an apartment.
So how did things end up for Megan Russell? She and her boyfriend snagged a one-bedroom loft with central air and a dishwasher for $1,250 a month, two neighborhoods south of Wicker Park. In Chicago, I'm Lauren Chulgen for Marketplace.
The United States is taking home 104 Olympic medals, Jeff. That is the most of any country.
And who's,
so we won on that front.
And who's second? Is it China?
China is second with 87, and I think the UK comes in third, which I'm sure they're very happy about since hosted the Olympics.
A reversal from Beijing. I think China beat us on the medals in Beijing. So
yeah, well, and also, of course, we had a big win yesterday in the basketball game with the new Dream Team.
That was a really close game.
It was a very close game, but it ended up well for the United States. But, you know, there is one winner at the Olympics that has no medals, interestingly.
Okay.
And it is something called kinesio tape. Do you know what that is?
No. Should I have rooted for it?
It lost yesterday to Yugoslavia in the competition of nations that no longer exist. But so anyway, it's basically these pink and blue strips that athletes put on their bodies to help muscles heal and perform better.
Yeah.
It wasn't an official Olympic sponsor, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it is getting a very big marketing boost.
Half down, up, down.
Exercise trainer Maricela Devine packs her Portland dance studio for cardio boot camp. She's wiry and rock hard, not a pulled hamstring in sight, but seeing all those Olympic athletes crisscrossed with kinesio tape?
Their bodies are these instruments that are fine-tuned, so yeah, I would definitely try it.
I think it's an interesting version of ambush marketing.
Sports lawyer Kenneth Shropshire says ambush because only official sponsors can plaster their logos on the Olympians. But kinesio tape? No brand name, so no foul. Just those unmistakable colored strips patterned across tight abs and glutes.
Athletes have gone beyond this is to help muscle strain or some other injury to, this looks pretty cool, let me put it on and further express myself.
Making the athletes a sort of straining, leaping billboard for the company, which says sales are up 15-fold since the Olympics began. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, you mentioned the U.S. has 104 medals for this Olympics. But here's another interesting question. How many medals should they have won? We talked about this the other day, and I thought I might just update it because it's interesting how it's changed. The Financial Times has been basically running kind of an economic forecasting model for metals. So how many medals should a country win based on its income, based on its sort of past performance, host country advantage in the case of Great Britain, right? So how did things come out? Well, you would think the U.S. had this great run at the end. It certainly felt like it.
Yeah. Right?
Like they got surprise gold in diving and a few other things. But in fact, the U.S. should have had two more medals than they had to match what would have been expected. They actually came up short. And China, the other day when we mentioned this, China was at the very top of the list. They were way outperforming even what you would expect from China. But that evaporated in the final days of the games, and they came out just about even with what you'd expect. And the country that did the best compared to expectations was Japan. Nobody's really talking about Japan in these Olympics, are they?
No.
Not much, but lots of silver and bronze for Japan, and I guess they can be happy with that. Not far behind Japan, Russia, Great Britain, and Iran was also kind of a surprise, lots of people are saying. The biggest disappointments, France and Australia at the very bottom of the list. Australia should have done much better.
Well, finally, Jeff, to Bellingham, Washington, which is, of course, very close to Canada. And it's actually a little too close if you ask some of the residents there who say that the Canadians are taking over the local Costco store.
Oh, no. What's that all about?
Well, the complaints are that the Canadians are so happy about their strong dollar that they're coming over and buying everything in the Costco, causing a parking nightmare and, you know, creating long lines at the gas station.
Canadians.
I guess they come over to get cheaper gas. But the Bellingham residents are so upset about this that they have started a Facebook page that calls on Costco to create a special shopping time for Americans only.
Oh, man.
Like adult swim time, all Canadians clear the pool or whatever.
We'll be checking checking IDs, I guess.
I guess, you know, or passports. But Costco does tell the CBC it's not going to happen.
Think of the profiling implications, people being, you know, being stopped just because they look Canadian and forced to shop in a different line.
I don't think that would work very well.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.